funniest, epiest, peopleist. I'm Lisa Bodner. Thanks for being here. Today, I'm really happy to share with you a conversation I had with Louisa Smith, an epi PhD student at Harvard. Louisa was incredibly generous to share her story of a diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer on this episode. If hearing about cancer is uncomfortable or triggering for you, maybe this isn't the episode for you. When Louisa learned about her breast cancer in February of 2018, she was only 28 years old. She was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer, which was ER positive, meaning that it has estrogen receptors, PR negative, which means it does not have progesterone receptors, and HER2 positive, which means it makes extra growth factor protein. The receptor status is important because although this subtype of breast cancer is particularly aggressive, it means that alongside standard chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation, it can also be treated with hormone-blocking drugs as well as newer targeted antibody therapies, which makes for a good prognosis. Louisa describes herself as an open book when it comes to her cancer. She describes in our conversation why sharing her story is important to her. I'll tell you that although this episode is largely about Louisa's cancer, it's really uplifting. She has such a positive outlook, and that translates into how she talks about her experience. Louisa allowed me to read a blog that she's written the past few years. It includes lots of photos, and she is smiling in almost all of them. And I think it's safe to say that it's a genuine smile. She interlaced her stories with really funny tidbits, videos, and photos. One was a slideshow of her hair loss and return, and below that was a series of her bitmojis that she created that went along with these changes. It was hilarious and amazing. Today, Louisa has no evidence of disease, and she's finishing up her dissertation. I hope you enjoy this show. Hi, Louisa.
Hello.
It's so great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
So you wrote this wonderful blog during your treatment and even now, and you generously allowed me to read it to prepare for today. So thank you for that trust.
You're welcome.
You've gone through so much in the last 3 years, and you very succinctly quantified what happened to you in the last few years. Could you read it?
Yeah. So I made this list trying to kind of capture a lot of the experiences that I had been through. I think I made it a year after my diagnosis, so it's not entirely up to date.
We need an erratum.
Yes, exactly. So I went through 16 rounds of chemotherapy, 2 major surgeries and 2 more minor surgeries, over 3 weeks of daily radiation. I ended up having 17 antibody infusions in addition to the chemo. At the time, I had gotten 13 hormone suppressing injections. These are things that I get every month. So it was a year and a half ago. So more than that now. I kept track of all of my appointments on a special calendar. And at this point, 1 year into it, it was up above 100, over 1,000 pills. And then I also kept track of some of the more academic things that I was doing alongside of my treatment. 2 written qualifying exams. I completed 5 classes as a student and 2 as a TA. I wrote 2 first author papers.
Yay!
And then
were published in Epidemiology, which is exciting.
Okay, included. Yes, it was very exciting. And then the less exciting things were I counted at least 4 crying spells at school, in public, in my office or in the classroom or in the student lounge, and at least 20 naps on the floor, usually right behind my desk. I stole a beanbag from the student lounge to keep there. So I ended up collecting a lot of data. I mean, obviously, I'm a data nerd in epidemiology. But I've always enjoyed collecting data on myself. So one reason I did this was to just keep track of my symptoms. So alongside this kind of list of numbers that I presented, I have kept track, for example, of the hot flashes that I was having for a while, just like installed a little button on my phone so I could keep track of those and graph those and present them to my doctors.
Were they asking you to keep track of that or some of the symptoms?
They ask me every time, like, oh, how are your hot flashes? Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? And I did start a drug to try to help make them better. And so I wanted to, you know, see if that was actually working and have something to tell them.
That's awesome.
When you have surgery, certain types of surgery, and you need to have fluid drained after the surgery so it doesn't build up, they send you home with drains to drain that fluid. And so they do ask you to keep track of the milliliters of fluid that drain off your body every, you know, 6-12 hours. So they, you know, they send you home with a little sheet and want you to handwrite how many milliliters of fluid and, you know, maybe the color or something.
And you're like, dude.
Yes. I don't handwrite anything. Like, that's too subject to error, you know. Totally. It's all going inside R, where I can keep track of it and make some really pretty graphs and do some, you know, analysis of the change over time and see whether the slope's changing. So I presented that to my doctor, and that was much appreciated.
Yeah. Was he like, I've literally never had a patient like you?
Yeah. They think I'm funny. I gave them to the assistant who was in charge of deciding whether or not to take out the drains first. And she was like, I do not know what to do with this. They promised that they would take them out when it was, I think, under 20 milliliters per day or something. So I just kind of graphed the rolling average over a 24-hour period. Said, look, this drain is under 20 milliliters. Take it out of me.
What were other things that you graphed?
So I went into my insurance account online and scraped the data for all my insurance claims. So in 2018, my hospital charged $639,000. Of that, my insurance company only paid $226,000. Wow. Luckily, I did not have to pay the rest.
So how did keeping track of this data help you over the course of that year?
Just gave me something to do and something to play with and something to learn more about. So that was helpful in that it was fun. I have forgotten some things that happened over the course of, you know, the past 2.5 years. And I don't know whether that's due to my chemo brain or just time passing or to trauma or whatever it might be. But it is good, I think, for me to look back and remember. I originally posted a bunch of these graphs on Twitter last year around this time, because it's October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. There has been a lot of backlash, especially from the metastatic breast cancer community, about how we're pumping all this money into making sure that people are getting mammograms, and there's not as much money in terms of research for prolonging people's lives. Putting my treatment experience into a more visual format helps people understand, you know, even when we're looking at this big population problem, because breast cancer is a big population problem, this is how it can affect individuals' lives. And so I think that was a useful way to share this experience.
Has it affected your view of epidemiology, how you actually do your work?
I do remember right after my diagnosis, like looking at a survival curve and feeling a way about a survival curve that I never felt before. Like, I've looked at a lot of survival curves academically and thinking of me being on that survival curve and where, you know, where I might fall was definitely a different feeling. It's been interesting trying to balance my beliefs about population health with individual health. So I'm in a group of young people with breast cancer, and a lot of times people will write in our Facebook group or advocate for the age at which to start mammograms to be a lot younger, or, you know, why are these 30-year-olds not getting mammograms? And, you know, I know epidemiologically, like, it makes absolutely no sense for us to give 30-year-olds mammograms. Like, that's just not an effective thing to do in terms of population health. But I also understand why on an individual level, people would say, oh, my doctor denied me a mammogram, and then I turned out to have breast cancer a year later. Like, why didn't they give me a mammogram a year ago?
You were in an RCT during your treatment. I think that every epidemiologist should be in an RCT at some point in their lives. The earlier, the better. What was it like and what surprised you?
So it was a trial for radiation. And my radiation oncologist is just wonderful. He does a lot of research. So the way he explained it to me is that for lumpectomies, radiation is standard of care. So you cut out the cancerous tumor and then you blast the breast with radiation to try to kill everything else around it. For people who have mastectomies, radiation is not standard of care if the cancer has not left the breast, because the idea is like, okay, if you just have a mastectomy, you cut out everything, it's gone, we're good. And studies have shown that lumpectomy with radiation and mastectomy have the same survival. So due to the specifics of my tumor and how far it had spread, I had to have a mastectomy and radiation. They have done studies of lumpectomies of two different treatment strategies. One is high dose radiation for fewer days, and the other one is lower dose radiation for longer days. And the traditional treatment in the US is lower dose radiation for longer days. And then in maybe Canada and, you know, the UK, it happens to be higher dose, shorter days. And so they have done studies comparing these in lumpectomy patients, comparing survival, all great. They're basically the same, but also comparing aesthetics. Radiation can really damage the skin. It can shrink the breast. It can do all these changes. So they've done these studies in lumpectomies, but had not yet done them in mastectomies. So this trial was comparing a course of radiation that would last 25 days versus a course of radiation that would last 16 days. And the only difference basically would be that you'd get a higher dose in the 16-day one, which was not is not currently standard of care in the United States. If I didn't do the trial, I would have to do radiation for 25 days, which is really annoying. Mm. If I was randomized into the intervention arm, I would get to only do it for 16 days. So I decided like that was really what I wanted to do. And I remember he called me later that day and was like, great news, you've been randomized into the intervention arm. And I was like, oh, this is so exciting. Like, I get to shorten my treatment. I get to try something new that will hopefully the results from this trial are great and that this can be offered to more people, because it's a huge inconvenience. And it's also just really annoying to go into the hospital every day and change your clothes and lie on this, you know, piece of metal and have, you know, these big radiation machines, I don't know the terminology, aiming at you.
Does it take a long time, the procedure itself?
No, it only takes like 15 minutes. Since my cancer is on my left side, it's right near my heart. So like you have to do these special breathing things, which are really, it's really scary, kind of the idea that there's this something that you can't see that's aiming for something that could hit your heart. But if you breathe in this certain way, it won't hit your heart.
Whoa.
So like...
Wait a minute. Like, how do they trust that people are going to breathe right?
So they have this thing on your chest, and different radiation facilities do this differently, that like sees when your chest is up and down, and then the technician guides you through it and says, you know, okay, big breath in and then big breath out. So they do only shoot it when you're breathing in the correct way, I guess.
See. Okay.
But it's a little bit stressful being like, okay, if I just like breathe out suddenly, everything's
or like, did I hear you right? Oh my gosh, yeah, did she say it? I missed it.
Because sometimes they kind of yell at you for doing it wrong and like breathing too deeply or too shallowly. And I'm like, I can't even get this normal human thing right.
And you were doing this so often, right?
Yeah,
it wasn't just like once. You were like, oh my God, I screwed it up on like minute 8 before. I can't do that again.
Yeah. And another reason to participate in the study is that they were giving a $50 gift card for each 6-month follow-up. So I was like, okay, great, $200.
I'm a student, yep. Totally.
Long story, I became ineligible for the trial after I'd already gone through it. So my doctor was like, oh, do you want to just like drop out? And I was like, no.
No.
Like, you need to keep this data on me. Like, it's still very important.
You're like, do you know me at all?
Yeah, I'm not dropping out. Also, I want that $50 gift card.
Totally. Did they have results?
Not yet.
You wrote in your blog about this amazing gift that your friends gave to you early in your treatment, right? Could you talk about it? This was so uplifting for me. It just like made my heart sing.
Yeah. So this was pretty early after my diagnosis, and I got this big box from my friends from Berkeley, where I did my master's. And I like open it up, and there are some, you know, socks and warm hats and just like all these lovely, comforting things. And then digging a little deeper, there were some treats from the Berkeley Bowl, which is the best grocery store in Berkeley. And then I get to the bottom, and there's a copy of Modern Epidemiology.
Which edition? I feel third. Like we need to clarify. Third edition. Okay.
And so, I mean, I already own Modern Epi version 3. So I was like, what is going on? Do they think I don't own this? And at the time, I had kind of been complaining that I wasn't studying, or not complaining, but just pointing out that I wasn't studying for my qualifying exams, because this diagnosis had happened, you know, right after I had started studying. And so I was like, oh, they're really like worried for me and really like want to encourage me to study. And like think that sending me this book will make me do it. And then so I noticed that there were little sticky notes poking out of some of the pages. And I was like, okay, these are the things I'm going to have to memorize for the qualifying exam. And then I open it up, and it's this really sweet kind of yearbook that they've written for me. Some of my friends there had both people that I know and went to school with, as well as some of the new students who don't even know me, the administrator that I knew, people signed this and had really a lot of nice things to say, just letting me know that they're thinking of me. A lot of them are inside jokes that I shouldn't share on, yeah. on a podcast. But one that I found really sweet was one person who wrote that their introduction to Epi was in fall 2015 with USMyGSI, what they call a TA at Berkeley. Now I'm a first year in the PhD program, and I have you to thank. Thank you for teaching me about 2x2 tables with such enthusiasm and kindness. So I thought that was so sweet.
Absolutely is. Yeah, what a lasting mark you had. Yeah. That's super cool.
Yeah, my old advisor wrote it in about, got the puzzle diagrams chapter marked up. So it's just a really, I don't know, a really sweet way of, you know, sharing some inside jokes and some experiences we had together, as well as just created a memorable little book for me to have. It also meant that I got to keep one of my copies at my office and one at home. So I always could reference Modern Epi when I needed it.
It's critical.
Yeah.
It's critical. Tim Lash would be very happy about that.
I'm sure. I kind of had this conversation with one of my advisors after, or in the middle of treatment. I had told everybody at school, like, this was clearly not a secret. I was completely bald and like was, you know, in and out. But I had a conversation with him where I was like, do you think, how open should I be about this when it comes to professionally? Because it's definitely a risk for anybody with any kind of, you know, disease or disability to be open about that, because it can and is, you know, held against people. And I didn't want people to think that I would be a liability, or, you know, think that I was going to keel over at any moment. And so he obviously left it up to me totally, but suggested that people in our field and public health in general are, he didn't think that it would be a problem for me to, you know, let people know that this had happened, which I was glad of. It would be, have been hard for me to keep this to myself. And, you know, I'm also, I think sharing it hopefully can help other people feel more comfortable with aspects of their health, or with, you know, sharing difficult things that have happened to them during their PhD. Like, when I am teaching, I I try to make it clear to students that if they have something that's going on that's preventing them from turning in an assignment or something like that, that that's very understandable, because I also, you know, came to points when I was just like, I actually cannot do this homework. And I have never felt like that before in my life. And it's just a totally different feeling.
Yeah.
I mean, I also just, I don't know. It's something that was really hard and challenging. And I'm proud of the fact that I like made it to the other side and still, hopefully, fingers crossed, will complete my PhD soon while going through all of this. So
yeah. When would that be, maybe?
Sometime in the spring, January or May.
Yeah. How is your work going?
It's going well. There have been a lot of setbacks.
Sure. Always.
Partly due to cancer, partly just due to, you know, data research. Availability yeah. and things like that. But I think I'm hopefully in a good place to graduate soon.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Congrats.
Thanks.
You're almost there.
Yeah.
So sort of speaking of that, I was thinking about how when you're training for a career, you're always thinking about the future. And I'm sure that people in your cohort were also talking about their graduation, their defense, where they were going to go next, their five-year plans. How was that impacting you?
At first, it was definitely really hard to even hear anybody talking about making plans.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing that happened was that I had to cancel all of my plans basically for the year of treatment that I thought, you know, would help my career. And, you know, like all these things are suddenly things that I can't do. It's really hard to travel when you're getting chemo every week. And so that was really hard. Also, just the idea that I, like, you know, didn't know whether at first whether I'd, you know, get to have a career. So that was definitely difficult. So it was hard to hear people talk about some things, but it also made it a lot easier for me to plan for my future in some ways, because I decided that I was done doing anything that I didn't enjoy or get some kind of personal satisfaction out, just for the sole purpose of it, you know, being good for me or like helping me in the future. So I think I was working on at the time a project in SAS, and I hate SAS. And I was just like, there's so many more interesting things that I want to work on. That's over.
Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. And I've tried to keep that mentality for better or for worse. I don't care. I'm going to do what I like. Like, there's plenty of stuff for me to do. And so who knows what'll happen in the future? And if I'm not, you know, the best candidate because I haven't done such and such thing, then who cares?
Tell me about how you decided where to go to school for your PhD.
I took a week off of school when I was trying to decide where to go in the spring of my second year of my master's, and traveled around visiting places and talking with professors, and kind of came to this point where I was like none of these places would be notably better than any of the other ones for me. So let's just leave it to chance.
I hope that you didn't say, Alexa, flip a coin.
Basically that. So this was March, and it was while March Madness was going on. So one of the schools was UNC, and UNC was playing in the Final Four. What if I just do my own Final Four? And I had kind of narrowed it down to four schools. So it was kind of perfect. I assigned each of them a team. UNC was obviously UNC, but the other schools were based on some combination of geography or letters in the name. So Villanova was Harvard because they both had V's. And I decided that I would just let basketball teams decide where I would go to school. I remember I was grading with my co-TAs. We had a computer going with the final basketball game, which was between Villanova and UNC. So Harvard and UNC for me. I was like, we have to pause grading. We have to watch. This is really momentous.
This is my future.
This is my future. I've never watched Final Four ever before in my life. I have no interest in basketball. It was the most incredible ending to a sports game I've ever seen.
I remember this ending. It was bananas.
It was absolutely wild. So I truly had no idea where I was going to school up until the last second when Villanova won on a buzzer beater. And I turned to my friends. I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to Harvard. And that's what I did. So one other weird situation I found myself in was on an outhouse racing team.
Wait.
So
say this again.
I was on an award-winning, I'm not sure it was an award-winning, we won the one and only competition per year of outhouse racing. There are teams of four who race around with an outhouse.
Wait, is it full?
The outhouse is not full. You actually have to build your own outhouse. This was kind of when Hunger Games was popular. Our team name was Plunger Games. And I was... not catniss, I was cat piss. It's in the winter in South Dakota. You run around this track of ice and snow, dragging this outhouse cart while one person sits on the toilet seat. It's really competitive. We like would put, you know, nails or screws in our shoes to help us run on the ice.
You didn't buy like crampons?
No, this was a low budget.
Okay. Was there drinking involved in this game?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Afterwards, absolutely. But and all of our friends throughout. But we, the racers, the four of us, absolutely not, because we had to be in tip-top racing condition.
What activity instantly calms you? Don't say data analysis. Because I think that's what you were going to say.
Possibly. No, I think my first instinct was to say teaching, even though it's not really, it doesn't make me feel calm. It makes me feel much more kind of present in the moment and not thinking about anything beyond that. I feel like when I'm teaching, I just kind of become a totally different person and am, you know, fully engaged. And I actually really enjoy that when I'm feeling stressed, because that's like kind of one of the few things that I can do that makes me leave anything else behind.
So you live with your parents, right?
Yeah. So I just moved in September. I gave up my apartment in Boston and moved in with my parents.
So what's the best and worst part of living with your parents?
The best part is that my mom cooks. I also cook and help out in the kitchen. The worst thing about living with my parents.
Are they going to listen to this podcast?
Yes. So
they will.
Well, so I told my mom.
For real?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I told my mom that I was going to be on this podcast today. And she said, oh, what's the topic? And I said, me. And she said, oh, so do they want to interview me?
Is your mom there?
She's downstairs.
Go get her. Go get her. Bring her up.
Okay, I'll go get her. Okay. Yeah, there she is. You're not actually on video.
First of all,
hi.
First of all, I'm hearing lots of laughter, and I have and I have no wine.
You're not actually on video.
Just stick your head in. Yeah,
this is Lisa.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
I'm Megan.
Hi, Megan. Luisa really loves living with you. Can I ask you a question that I asked Luisa?
Sure.
I asked her, what is the best and the worst thing about living with her parents? Can I ask you what the best and worst thing is about living with Luisa?
And I don't get to hear her answer, right?
You can, but you're the podcast.
I mean, Luisa is really fun to talk about things with and to laugh with and to cook with. I mean, there are so many reasons that I love having her here. The worst thing... Great. She often forgets to bring her dishes to the sink.
Luisa, come on. You're not 16. Louisa shared with me her blog. It was so moving and informative and helpful to read.
My mom was crying.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to make you cry. If this is too much.
No, it's fine. Stop. It's okay. Fine.
I read your entry and I thought it was wonderful that you wrote something too to give some additional perspective. And I also just want to say that to go through all of this, you're such a strong woman.
Thank you. I have a strong daughter, so.
You do. Oh my gosh. The two of you. Well, I just wanted to meet you.
Well, thank you. It was nice meeting you.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks, please.
You're welcome.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate your time, Louisa. This is so much fun to get to know you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you for sharing your story. I'm so happy you're doing well.
Thanks. Well, I did realize that I didn't say the worst thing about living with my parents.
Oh, what's the worst?
Well, I just thought of this when my mom came in, is that my mom, like, she's like one of the children who's interrupting their parents while they're trying to work. I have had to share my calendar with my mom so she doesn't like come and knock on the door and say like, hey, what's up? While I'm in the middle of a Zoom meeting.